This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Job. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Job, chapter 25, with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
Once there was a journalist assigned to the Jerusalem Bureau. She rented a flat that overlooked the Wailing Wall of Jerusalem. And every day, as she looked down at the Wailing Wall, she noticed the same old Jewish fella. He would go to the wall and he would pray vigorously. Well, this journalist could smell a story. And so one day she met him and she asked him, "You come to this wall every day to pray. How long have you been doing this and what do you pray about?" The man replied, "Well, I've been coming to the Wailing Wall every day for 25 years. In the morning, I pray for world peace. I go home, have a cup of tea, and then I come back at night and I pray for the eradication of disease." Well, the journalist was amazed. "Boy, how does it feel to come to this place every day for 2.5 decades and pray?" The old man said sadly, "Like I'm praying to a wall." Well, that's about how Job felt in relationship to his prayers. Job has been asking why he's been struck by this calamity, but God doesn't answer. Job felt like someone who was talking to the proverbial telephone pole. Job had asked to know why, and God had stayed silent. Job was demanding to know why, but God wouldn't say. Job was screaming to know why, but God remained silent. Job was pounding his fist and daring God to tell him why, but God remained silent. It was like Job was praying to a wall, but God was watching, and God was listening, and God was preparing to respond to Job. In fact, God will pay Job a visit soon enough. But when God is ready, not when Job says jump. In the meantime, Job struggles in silence. And here's the problem when the person you're talking to chooses to stay silent. You can draw the wrong conclusions. You know, when my wife doesn't speak to me, I jump to all kinds of conclusions. I assume, oh no, what have I done? If my son doesn't speak to me, I think, oh no, what has he done? Silences are difficult to interpret. You can draw the wrong conclusions. Which reminds me of Earl and Diane. They went to the county fair one day, and Earl wanted to ride the stunt plane that was there at the fair. You could ride the stunt plane for $50. Earl said to his wife, said, "Honey, I really want to ride that stunt plane." Diane replied, "Earl, you know money's tight. $50 is $50. Well, this went on for years. Every year they would go back to the fair, and Diane would always answer him, "$50 is $50. Well, one year, Earl, he asked Diane, he said, "Honey," he said, "I'm 75 years old. If I don't go up in that stunt plane soon, I won't have a chance." "Earl, $50 is $50. Well, the stunt plane pilot, he overheard the conversation. And so he offered them a deal. He said, "If you can remain silent on this flight the whole time, there will be no charge for the flight. But if I hear one squeal from either one of you, it's going to cost you $50. Well, the pilot, he tried every twist and turn he could possibly remember, anything he could do to try to get this couple to scream, to say a word, but not a peep. Well, after landing, he told Earl, he said, "Wow," he said, "I was surprised. How did you stay quiet? How did you do it?" And Earl said, "Well, it wasn't easy. I almost screamed when Diane fell out of the plane. But you know, $50 is $50. You know, you can draw false conclusions from someone else's silence. And Job is the classic example. He concluded that God saw him as his enemy. He accused God of having wronged him. He felt that God had abandoned him. Sadly, tonight, we're going to watch Job grope a while longer in his darkness and in his silence. Remember, the book of Job was probably the first biblical book penned. That means that Job is without a Bible. That means that Job never read the first two chapters of the book of Job. And yet Job is trying his best to make some kind of sense out of his mess. Well, tonight we're in chapter 25. It's Bildad's turn to speak. He talks for just 6 verses, and then for the next 6 chapters, Job vents his pain and his frustration. Verse 1, then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, dominion and fear belong to him, meaning God. He makes peace in his high places. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does he light his light not rise? In other words, God lights the world for everyone. Who doesn't benefit from his grace, he asked Job. How then can man be righteous before God? Or how can he be pure who is born of a woman? God lights the world. Job, you're a mere mortal. Job, you're a human being. God is divine. God is great. So, Job, who do you think you are to want to carry on a conversation with God? He says, if even the moon does not shine, and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man who is a maggot and a son of man who is a worm? The moon shines a light into the dark night. The stars are suns that light up deep space. And yet God is not really impressed with the moon or the stars. They both pale in comparison to God's infinite glory. The Almighty is greater than any part of his creation. And compared to the radiance of the stars, man is a maggot. I got a picture. Man is a maggot. Man is just a worm. Look at yourself in the mirror and say, hi, maggot. Compared to God's glory, we're a maggot. We're a worm. Why would God give to Job the time of day? Obviously, hidden from Bildad was God's love for Job. And hidden from Bildad was the exalted position that God had given to man after his creation. Well, it's interesting that this is Bildad's third and final speech to Job. The third counselor, Zophar, he doesn't have a third turn. He apparently remained quiet after this. If Zophar did make a final speech, it wasn't recorded. It's interesting, though, that in the end, none of the three men could pin a sin on Job. Oh, they hurled all kinds of accusations against him, but like jello thrown up on a wall, none of their charges ever stuck. Job remained innocent. Chapter 26, Job responds. He answers and says, how have you helped him who is without power? In other words, you've done me no good. You really haven't helped me much at all. How have you saved the arm that has no strength? I mean, I'm down and you've done nothing for me. How have you counseled one who has no wisdom? And how have you declared sound advice to many? To whom have you uttered words? And whose spirit came from you? You see, Job had disagreed with their counsel. They were of no help to him at all. Their sound advice was nothing to him but dribble. It's interesting now, in chapter 26, Job is going to compare the wisdom that God demonstrated in creation with the wisdom of his counselors. In fact, Job 26 is a very, very provocative chapter. For in this chapter, we glean some details of the creation that we find nowhere else. Keep in mind, the book of Job was the first Bible book written. It was authored by Moses, probably before he compiled Genesis. Its contents predate Moses' day. Job is an old book, and it records some very cryptic and some very intriguing details about the creation that you find nowhere else in the Scripture. And we get them right here in chapter 26, verse 5. The dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting them. Notice that. Where did the dead tremble? Under the waters and inhabiting the waters. Now, in the Old Testament, the abode of the dead was known as Sheol. The Greek term, or the New Testament term, is Hades. Today, Hades is inhabited by the spirits of unbelievers. And Sheol, or Hades, is a frightful place. Understand that. It's also called the bottomless pit. It's where the worm doesn't die and the fire isn't quenched. Understand, people don't party in Hades. people in Hades tremble. But notice where Hades is located. Here we're told, under the waters. Throughout the Bible, the sea has evil connotations. And here we learn why. Because the sea borders up and mingles with hell. In Revelation 13, the beast or the Antichrist is seen coming out of the sea. In Revelation 9, demons arise from the sea at the mouth of the Euphrates that destroy a third of mankind. Remember when the storm kicked up on the Sea of Galilee? It tried to drown Jesus. And Jesus, he rebuked the sea. Jesus spoke to the sea as if you would speak to a demon. In Micah 7, we're told that our sins are buried, where? In the deepest parts of the sea. And finally, in the new earth, in the ultimate perfection, the ultimate recreation of God, guess what's not there in the new earth? There is no sea. Throughout the scriptures, the sea has a seamy, sinister reputation. In Matthew chapter 12, when Jesus predicted his death and resurrection, he said, "For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." In the fish's belly, Jonah was at the bottom of the sea, or at the heart, or the center of the earth. Likewise, when Jesus died, he went to Sheol, where there he preached to those held captive. Obviously, Sheol, or Hades, is not some Atlantis, some literal underwater world. That's not what I'm suggesting. Sheol exists in a spiritual dimension, another realm. And yet apparently the coordinates of Sheol somehow overlap with the sea. Evidently the spirit world is also underwater, under the seas, at the heart of the earth. Now, I have a serious book in my library. It's entitled The Bible and the Bermuda Triangle. In it, it theorizes the existence of dimensional warps or corridors between the physical and spiritual realms that rise up out of the sea. Remember, Jesus spoke of the gates of hell, entranceways into hell. These could be actual areas on an oceanic map where the spiritual and physical worlds mingle and overlap. It's interesting that the Earth's deepest oceans are the Puerto Rican Trench in the Caribbean, aka the Bermuda Triangle, and the Marianas Trench off the coast of Guam in the South Pacific. Another name, the Devil's Triangle. Both areas are infamous for their mysterious supernatural phenomena that occur in these waters. Is it possible that some of the strange reports might be the result of demonic activity occurring around the gates of hell? This is a provocative chapter. There could be a lot of truth to that. Job's point, though, is this: all evil trembles at God's presence. Even Sheol trembles at God's presence. Verse 6, Sheol is naked before him, and destruction has no covering. Revelation 9 names the angel of the bottomless pit, the king of hell. He is called Abaddon, or destruction. Here Job is saying that even the king of hell trembles before God. He stretches out the north over empty space. He hangs the earth on nothing. Now remember, these are the words of a man living 4,000 years ago, a man who never saw a telescope, let alone looked through one. How does he know that the earth is suspended over empty space? And yet his description here of the cosmos fits very nicely in any of today's textbooks on astronomy. In fact, a modern astronomer would be hard-pressed to come up with a better explanation of the cosmos than what we find right here, that God hangs the earth on nothing. That's pretty accurate. Compare the accuracy of Job's description with the creation myths of the ancient cultures. When you do, it's obvious that Job's insights were divinely inspired. The Egyptians, for example, they said that there was this egg that existed in this primeval sea. It hatched the sun god, who had four sons. And through their rivalries with each other, the world was created. That was the Egyptians. The Greeks said that the earth was held up by the arms of a giant named Atlas. The Hindus taught that the earth rested on the back of three elephants, which stood on the shell of a tortoise that swam along in a primeval ocean. In contrast, Job's statements are astonishingly accurate. Scientifically and astronomically, he says that God hung the earth on nothing. Here's another interesting thought before we leave verse 7. We're told he stretches out the north over empty space. In other words, God gave to the earth a northward projecting axis that points toward the North Star. This gives the earth its orientation in the starscape. Thus, anywhere on our planet, north becomes up or above, whereas south becomes down or below. It's interesting, Psalm 75 suggests that God's throne is in heaven and that heaven is in the north. It says, exaltation comes neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south, but God is the judge. So where does God live? By process of elimination there, he doesn't live in the east or west or south. Obviously, God lives in the north. Where is heaven? Heaven is in the north. By heaven being in the north, it's implied that God resides there. And I want to clarify this. I'm not suggesting that God is a Yankee. When I say that heaven is in the north, God forbid that God would be a Yankee. I mean, everybody knows that God is a southern gentleman. In fact, if we get to heaven and God says, "Hi, you guys," I'm going to be really disappointed. You know, just as hell is in a parallel dimension at the earth's center, heaven could also be in a parallel realm above us, situated in the north, situated above us. Is this why all compasses point north? Could they be pointing us all back to heaven, back to God? Verse 8 tells us, God binds up the water in his thick clouds, yet the clouds are not broken under it. You remember when we studied, and remember Job was written a long, long time ago, back as close to the flood as we can get. And when we studied the pre-flood era, we noted evidence that before the deluge, the earth was surrounded by a global vapor canopy. Thick clouds shrouded the earth and shielded the earth from the sun's harmful radiation. This allowed people to live long lives. This was why Methuselah lived to be 969 years old, and we have the other long lives back in Genesis. It also turned the antediluvian world into a tropical paradise. God's thick clouds, as Job called them, maybe a reference to that pre-flood atmosphere. He goes on and he says, God covers the face of his throne and spreads his cloud over it. He drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. Here's another amazingly accurate insight for a man living 4,000 years ago. The ancients thought that the world was flat. But Job says that God drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters. Job understood that the earth was a sphere. You know, the Bible taught the earth was round millenniums before Christopher Columbus discovered the New World. It's another proof of the Bible's supernatural origin. He goes on, the pillars of heaven tremble and are astonished at his rebuke. He stirs up the sea with his power, and by his understanding, he breaks up the storm. Not only do the dead in Sheol tremble before God, but apparently so does heaven. Notice he says, by his spirit, he adorned the heavens. His hand pierced the fleeing serpent. And here's where it really gets provocative. Here's another creation detail. God's spirit, we're told, adorned the heavens. Remember Genesis 1, verse 2. That's the first place where the Holy Spirit appears, right there in the beginning. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And who was there? And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light." Boom, and there was light. Study this picture now. Think it through. The earth is without form and void. Isaiah 45, verse 18, look it up later. Isaiah 45, verse 18 says that God made nothing that was without form and void. What God made had form. It had content and substance. God made nothing without form and void. Perhaps it became that way when Satan fell. So here we have the earth. It's covered with this evil sea. And the Spirit is now brooding over the waters. God is about to initiate His recreation in these 7 days of creation. When, according to Job, suddenly His hand pierced the fleeing serpent. The devil is in the stormy waters. The devil is in the waters. The sea serpent, the dragon, as he's called in Revelation, is in the sea. And the dragon is in the sea trying to stop God's creative work when suddenly the Spirit of God pierces him and causes him to flee. Then God says, light, and there was light. It's interesting. Psalm 89, verses 9 and 10 paints the same picture of creation, that it was a battle. That creation was actually a battle between God and the sea serpent. There we're told that He breaks Rahab, the proud Leviathan, again the dragon, into pieces. Did you know there are ancient tales from the Canaanites and from the Babylonians and even from the American Indians that talk of the Creator slaying a sea serpent at creation and then using the pieces of that sea serpent as the stuffing or the stuff for His creation, as the elements for His creation? These are some bizarre myths, but they may just have a kernel of truth. Here we know from Job that His Spirit adorned the heavens by piercing the serpent. Indeed, these are the mere edges of His ways. Isn't that the truth? I mean, all the knowledge from all the brightest minds in every field of study, they're just the edges of God's ways. Man's knowledge of the universe is so infantile compared to the mind of God that it's romper room chatter. It's nursery rhymes in contrast to the mysteries of God. The basic building blocks of tomorrow's science are still today's secrets. Indeed, these are the mere edges of His ways, and how small a whisper we hear of Him, but the thunder of His power, who can understand? The most brilliant theologian knows but a faint whisper compared to the thunder of who God truly is. Chapter 27. Moreover, Job continued his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my justice in the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. In other words, Job says, I will never lie. And that's why he's never said that his calamity was caused by his sin, because he affirms that that's not true, that he's innocent. He continues, far be it from me that I should say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. Job is going to cling to his innocence until the day he dies. May my enemy be like the wicked, and he who rises up against me like the unrighteous. Now, Job's friends have accused him of wickedness. Here he turns the tables, and he hopes that God will treat them like wicked men. They need to be judged after what they've put him through.
You've been listening to Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams, here at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is working his way through the book of Job, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. Here we find an account of extreme trial and hardship unleashed on Job. He lost his children, his herd, his home, his health, all of it. Satan was putting him to the test. He wanted Job in his suffering to speak against the very character and name of God. Have you ever felt that if one more thing were to go wrong in your life, it would just break you? This is how I imagine Job must have felt. We all have painful times that we walk through, but the question remains, will you still trust God? Will you trust in His sovereignty and mercy in your life? To hear more messages like this one, head over to sandyadams.org. Once again, that's sandyadams.org. While you're there, check out Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain under the About tab. If you're in the Atlanta area, why not come visit us? We have services at 9:15 and 11:15 a.m. There's more information and directions at sandyadams.org. You can also contact us by calling 770-736-2828. That number again is 770-736-2828. Until next time, this has been another edition of Sandy Adams Radio.